Good evening and welcome to Yada Yada Radio. My pleasure to be with you. We have our full cast of characters. JB, how are you?
I'm good.
Captain Kirk, you got to rest your voice. You did do an observation show with Scott off helping a family friend. And Larry, I think you're the only one that actually watched the presidential debate. What were your thoughts?
My thoughts is that they did their research and they understood that they could bait him into rolling around in the mud with the Clintons, and if you do that, you lose, because mud doesn't stick to the Clintons. And you know, when you got a guy, if you didn't watch the debate, you have to understand that this clown that they call a newsman, it was 2-on-1 is what it was. You know, when you've got serious issues like, you know, people that are suddenly worth $250 million when neither one of them have a job, and you know, people taking the Fifth Amendment, for God's sakes, even and the FBI. So I guess you got the news media, the FBI. You know, it almost leads me to believe that Trump is a real candidate. For the first time in many, 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 many years. Now, whether the guy's a decent guy, I've only known two people that have ever met him, my daughter being one, and he was very kind to her, and another guy that I worked with at Gallup. He was eating a dinner at just like Brittany was at a place where Trump was eating dinner, and Don, that's his name, walked up to Trump and said, "Will you do me a favor when you leave? You know, he was trying to land a client." And he says, "So when you leave, will you come up to the table and say, 'Hey, Don, I'm going to get back to you on that.'" He said, "Sure, I'll do it." And he did. You know, I mean, he just actually, he's kind of a blue collar kind of guy, is my understanding. You know, now he's not strategically, apparently, I guess legally he's pretty smart, but strategically in a debate he was awful. And that's what I would tell you.
Yeah, that's been my experience in watching him, is that that his first attempt at a press conference early in the primary campaign, he started off magnificently. It was clear that he had considerable intellect and that he had a pretty decent grasp of the issues. But it became painfully obvious along the way that he can't control himself. Like right now, he's lambasting a Miss Universe candidate rather than just saying, "Why would I comment?"
Well, you know what's worse about that is, yeah, I actually heard what he really said about her, at least publicly. And when the press, you know, she gained some Miss Universe contestant, she gained 60 pounds in a year. I mean, this is a beauty contest, and she's supposed to rep for them. You know, she's under contract. She was completely out of control. And let me tell you, he said very nice things about her. I mean, this was from back then. I heard it. And what he had said was, "Let's give her a chance. I mean, what kind, you know, don't throw the woman away. She's a very beautiful, sweet young woman. Let's help her." You know, that was what he, those were his words back then, at least publicly.
Now I don't know what he gave her a chiding, or what he has said subsequently, but it's the lead item in the news that he is calling her all sorts of names.
I saw her do an interview, and what she said, apparently this woman is real wacko. And they brought up the fact she was a driver in a murder, you know, and threatened to kill some prosecutor. And you know what she said? "We all have a past, and I am no saint." You know, this was it. She admitted to it. And it's like I'm sitting there going, this isn't the most insane. You know, if you allow the Clintons, and I'm just saying this from, you know, I've watched them over the years. Anyone who allows the Clintons to pull you down into a mud wrestling contest, you're in trouble, because they're good at it. They don't care. Yeah. You could say anything to them, It doesn't, and every bit of it can be true, and it won't matter. They won't flinch. They'll look at you like you're crazy and start talking about something else.
One of the reasons why early on when Tiwa Teres came out, even before Tiwa Teres and Prophet of Doom, as I was exiting my last business, I came to realize that there is literally no way to prevail if you get down in the mud and try to wrestle with the pigs. Everybody loses in a wrestling match with a pig. That's why you have
right. Well, you know, when I was watching that, I was thinking about you, not wrestling with a pig, but I thought, you know, I really wanted to ask you this. You know, now here you are, this high-powered billionaire. Billionaire. I mean, there's only a couple hundred of you that ever were on the planet, or at least in the U.S. And it would be, you know, I remember Ross Perot years ago. He surrounded himself with yes men. I mean, they were like professional yes men, you know, shined his shoes and poured his water and that kind of thing. And I thought, well, you know, it would have to be, you'd have to have a guy who hasn't surrounded himself with yes men. And my question to you is that when you're in that kind of position, isn't it easy to surround yourself with people that are just going to agree with everything you say?
The difficulty in being in that position is that most people are attracted to power and wealth, and they are disingenuous to try to solicit the opportunity to wield and have access to power and wealth. And so you do get in a position where you begin to question most everybody's integrity. And what I found is that the people who come across as trying to establish themselves as honest are usually the most dishonest. The people who come across as the most religious are the least trustworthy. And those who are the most flattering are usually the least sincere. So I really preferred to be surrounded by people who would put up a good fight, who would put up had conviction and would hold to that conviction, would argue the point up to the point where you said, I've heard your argument, you make a lot of good points, but this is the way we're going to do it. So let's do it this way. And, if you did that respectfully, if you gave the person their due, if you complimented them on their willingness to advance their ideas, and at that point, those are usually the people that you could trust to carry out whatever the proposition was, where the person that was yes, yes, yes all the way along, you turn your
kind
back
of a
on
spineless.
Them and, spineless. They have no character, no conviction. So I really preferred, I've always preferred in life strong personalities. I want people that will stand their ground. I think that there's a lot of reasons that I really like Gao, and one of them is I think he has a preference for characters. I think he likes strong personalities. I think he likes people who will bow their back and say, I don't like that. I mean, there are things in the Torah process
that
I don't like. Yeah.
He says we're all stand up. I mean, that's the word he uses. I mean,
right.
So whether it's standing up, obviously, Yahweh, we already know, he could present himself as the all-powerful, get us to bow down and agree with everything he says and all these other things instead of making a choice to say, that's life, I want to go with life.
Yep.
But he made us for the purposes of relationship, and that's really the wine of life. I think that's one of the other reasons for wine, by the way. I really do.
Yeah.
It's
a relationship catalyst.
Yes, and so it is. And so I think that's why there's so few. That's part of the reason why there's thousands.
Yeah, I think he likes strong personality. I think one of the reasons that even in the family, as we get together, we exchange emails, we talk on programs like this, and occasionally a couple of us will go at it. And I think the reason is that, you know, the family is filled with the stand-up people with backbone and character who don't just go along. There's, you know, we've all been conditioned not to respect authority, not to trust other people. And so there's a natural tendency for us all to bow our back. And, you know, we have very strong loyalties as it relates to Yahweh. So we are.
Let me ask you a question.
We're prone to bone our back, yeah.
I did a little study on Adon versus Edon.
Yeah.
I know you did quite a big piece on it, but I ran across it while I was translating last week and found some really interesting things. And then I started thinking about why it has to be Edon, upright, instead of Adon, king, lord, master.
Right.
And then I started thinking, well, you know, it's impossible for Yahweh to be king, lord, and master.
Impossible.
It is incredibly against his character.
It is.
You know, he's already said, I'm a father. I cannot be. So to call him that is an insult to his character. It certainly is.
Oh, it's a total.
Explaining his character, you know, you know what I mean. It's just a.
It's corruption of his nature would be the best way to put it.
So we cannot. It could never be Adonai. It can never be Lord. It can never be Master. He doesn't think of himself as king. It doesn't mean you can't be the superior being. It doesn't mean you can't be the creator. And it doesn't mean that you're not the father. It's just
and it doesn't mean that he's still in charge. You mean he is the ultimate authority. He's still in charge. It is his universe. It's his home. Life is his creation. And if you want to have extended life, live in his home. He has established the rules, and it's his home. It's he's entitled to establish the rules. But you're right.
Not
interested
to be overloading, being, you know, bow down to
that environment.
We think of no terms.
Right. We are not going to approach him as king. We're not going to approach him as a lord, as a master. We're going to approach him as father.
I mean, he doesn't even treat you like he's an owner because he gives you free wills on everything. And he asked, you know, and like we found out a couple of weeks ago, he says, please.
Well, that's a point of
mine. I really want you to do that. For you and for me.
Yeah. It's a very
good thing.
The
owners don't do that. They
say,
get over there. You know? Get over there, sit down, and shut up. You know?
Again, that's a corruption of his nature, which is perfectly in line with this world, isn't it? I mean, presented to us is presented in a corrupted form originally. I mean, really.
Yeah. One of the most controversial assessments I think I made was that Yahweh never wants Adon to be associated with him. Now, it's easy to see how Adon is inappropriate as a replacement for Yahweh, but when you have individuals that refer to Yahweh, and you have Aleph, Daleth, Nun, and you are you realize that 99.9999% of translators render it Adon as opposed to Edon, same letters. I mean, there's no difference. You would find it impossible to differentiate between Adon and Edon in the text. And so,
because it's
my natural proclivity, and this is a really an important conclusion here, but my natural proclivity in translating is that first and foremost, make certain that what you convey is consistent with Yahweh's nature and plan. So while there is no way to differentiate between Adon and Edon in the text, if it's being applied to Yahweh, I almost always render it as Edon, because
not almost,
it is
always.
There's a couple of. I always do it. There are a couple of places where I think it could be either way. For example, when Moshe is confronted by Yahweh, and they meet for the first time, and they're...
you mean he calls him Lord because he doesn't know him? Sure, that could happen.
There is the possibility that he referred to him as Lord.
There probably is
that possibility. Now, I didn't translate it that way. I still translated it as Edon, because it's in the Torah, and when Aleph Daleph Nun is used in the Torah, it is the propensity is overwhelming for it to be rendered the upright pillar of the tabernacle. And since the upright one in holding us upright, standing up for us, and the wall being the means to hold up that upright pillar of the tabernacle. And all of the references to Yahweh as upright and his desire to make us like him and therefore upright, it's so pervasive, and it's so consistent with his nature. And it's so consistent even with his name, the way it's written, that I almost always render Aleph Daleph Nun as Edom. Now, the difficulty...
Well, you know, plus you got to throw in the fact that, an ass knows his Lord, right? I mean...
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's God.
You know, I mean, he actually makes fun of people calling him Lord.
Of course.
So, yeah.
And there's lots of places where Edom is used in context with an upright pillar, where the verbiage preceding it or following it directs you right to the upright pillar connotation of his name, particularly in Yashaya. So it is prevalent in that regard. But
in Malachi, he talks about my upright pillar as in Yahusha, which is a Dominican manifestation.
Yeah, he was the upright one. He stood up for us. So
he wasn't calling himself. He wasn't calling his diminished manifestation my Lord. That's for sure.
Yeah, and really, the doorway of Passover has two upright pillars.
Mm-hmm.
And there's constant references to an upright pillar throughout the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. That it is one of the most common metaphors for Yahweh's nature and his role in fulfilling the beneficial promises of the covenant. So, go ahead.
Now, I was just going to toss in a couple of things that I found that kind of clinched the deal. You know, if you look up Edom, Edonai, Edonoi, you get Lord,
right.
Master, and Owner. We've already discussed that just then.
Yeah.
So
that's
not appropriate.
You know what the difference between Edom and Adonai is?
Plural? I don't know.
No.
I'm not sure.
Now, the difference between
Adonai is
My Lord.
The Yod at the end makes it first person pronoun. So it's the Adonai is my Lord.
Okay, then
my Lord, my Master.
Yeah, that's good.
Did you hear that, Kirk?
Yes, I
got it. Did you get that?
I know it, but y'all have to remember. I'm older than all of you, so that's I have these little senior moments.
Right. Well, you're older and greater than I.
That's right.
True.
I'm older. Adon, when you start getting all the connective tissue, Adon is
Kirk Akbar. Kirk Akbar. Kirk is greater and older.
In my class, I'm here on Friday evenings.
Yes.
Whatever.
All right, go ahead. What did you learn on Adon?
I was trying to find some place where it could contradict your section on that, is where they could have gotten it another way. And
then
you go to Adan, and that's a place in Babylon. That's not his home. He's not associated with that. Won't even go there.
No.
He's trying to ask somebody to get out.
Right.
Bezek is Lord of the Canaanites. It's also a place related in Canaanites. They relate that again to Palestine. Of course, we know Palestine. We're talking about different animals.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bezek is, believe it or not, Bezek from the Adonai Bezek, is a lightning flash or a bolt of lightning. And then I started...
Well, we know what that's associated with.
There's two references that come to mind immediately for that. There's the lightning bolt that came from when Halal descends down that Yahusha saw. And then there's the lightning bolt that Paul experiences on the road to Damascus.
Right. Yeah, and you're familiar with the principal Greek Roman god of Ephesus. Do you know who that was?
The bolt? With the lightning bolt?
Who was the principal god of Ephesus? Where Paul and Yaokanan had their great rivalry. Adonis.
Adonis.
Yeah,
okay.
Adonis.
Oh, yeah.
You know what Adonis is based on?
The easy one. Yeah, that was the easy one.
Yeah.
Well, that's Adonai there.
I mean, absolutely. Adonis is based on my Lord. It's Adon. And you know that Babylon is the Greek transliteration of the name of the place. Babel is the actual name of the place, and also the Hebrew word for it. Do you know that that Bel was the principal god of Babylon? And you know what Bel means?
Yes.
Yeah, Bel is the Babylonian pronunciation or spelling, if you will, of Baal.
Baal,
the Lord.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are lots of strong indications. I think that my favorite happens to be the one in Hosea, where Yahweh was talking about his return, and the first thing he says upon his return, and this is now the he returns on Yom Kippurim, and he immediately, as we're going to see here in Yahshua, he eliminates all traces of religion and politics and militarism. And in Hosea, the first thing that he says is that one of the great benefits of his return is he will never have to hear my Lord ever spoken again. There's another place, I think it's in Jeremiah, but Larry, you could probably correct me, where Yahweh is talking about the most egregious crime that has ever been committed. And there's two places where God refers to a specific crime and calls it the most egregious ever committed. One of them, of course, was and I think it's at Ezekiel, this one, where he says that, you know, it was unforgivable for Yisrael, Yehudim, to preach that uncircumcised men could enter my home in heaven. And that was one. But the other one is where he says, when they replaced my name with Baal, the Lord, that was the single most egregious crime ever perpetrated on humanity.
And totally unforgivable.
Yes.
Yeah, that's in Jeremiah. On account of Baal, you mean?
Yeah, on account of Baal, the greatest crime ever perpetrated against humanity, according to Yahweh, was when they replaced his name Yahweh with the Lord, with Baal, and then there's Ezekiel where he says that it's the greatest crime really against the spiritual realm was this notion that of saying that uncircumcised men were somehow welcome into his home when it's not the case. So God's really serious about not being referred to as the Lord. And so, I just put the pieces together in all of this, and it sounds like you came to the same conclusion.
I couldn't find an argument against it. So.
Right, and if you want to be a Lord, you sure as hell have to have a word for submission.
Yes.
You have to have a word for obey.
You have to have obey.
Yeah, if you want to be a Lord and you want to be perceived as the Lord and Master, then you not only have to have a word for obey, you better use it a lot.
Yeah, you better have him. We have resources.
Yeah, and the fact that he has no word for obey, that tells you a lot. You know, I was watching a little bit of a program last night. It was on the, I don't know if it's the History Channel or some other program, but it was the greatest accomplishments, the greatest finds in ancient Egypt. I don't know who's got the dog in the background there, but it's really pretty loud. The what they were talking about Ramses, and of course they wanted to convey the fact that Ramses' wife is the one that plucked Moshe out of the Nile, when that absolutely was not the case. Ramses was not the Pharaoh of the Exodus. But the interesting thing is that those that have studied the hieroglyphics, particularly about Ramses, came to the conclusion that he only had two duties. He was his job was to be the chief warrior, so that through the military he would be able to protect Egypt. And of course, the Egyptians didn't try to protect themselves from invaders. They were conquest oriented, so they went out and attacked other people. And the second is that he had to be initially the intermediary between man and God, and then Ramses chose to present himself as God. So the temple of Abu Sabel, for example, is Ramses presenting himself as a god, as equal with the gods. And you just
got, I got a question for you here. Was this particular show advancing what a great culture Egypt was? I'm going to guess it was.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. And how brilliant Ramses was for this for representing himself as a god.
Playing Pope. Yeah, the first Pope or whatever, second Pope.
Yeah, those were lords and masters. They demanded obedience. And then they moved on with this, and they talked about how the priests, and after Ramses' death, participated in robbing all of the tombs of the pharaohs. Now, the pharaohs in the afterlife were supposed to be protectors of Egypt. Well, they participated in robbing the tombs, but they took the pharaohs' mummies, and after stripping all of the wealth and gold from them, piled them up in this one cave, and they said, boy, that was such a wonderful gift that they gave us, because now we can study and figure out how they lived, as opposed to condemning them for establishing a religion for their own personal wealth.
Yeah, this is right in line with everything that we see in the world. So yeah, this is
it's never been any different.
Yeah, knowledge is a good thing if it's actually used to learn something. Knowledge for the sake of knowing something without learning anything is worthless. That's like the difference between yada and religion.
Most of man's culture, if you go back in time, that education was either, like in Sumer, 100% of education was provided by the religious elite.
Yeah, the clergy. Yeah, and that happened during the Dark Ages, too.
Right, yeah. And
so, they're only sourced in.
And it's being provided by the religious elite, and the religious elite do not provide education so that people can be enlightened and think for themselves. They educate and indoctrinate those that they want to share power with so that they stay in power. The second group that they educate is military officers. They do not educate the men who actually fight, but they do educate the military officers, and that was the case also in Greece and in Rome. And they will educate those that are royalty. No one else.
Well, that's the whole reason behind the Rhodes scholarships.
Yeah.
To make everybody so they could have a little surrogate Englishman pulling the same strings as everybody else.
Well, just because you brought that up, years ago when I heard that such and such and so and so was a Rhodes Scholar, they were dropping this like this was just an incredible
thing. Yeah, Clinton was a Rhodes Scholar.
I know. That was actually the person I'm referring to. And so I went and checked what a Rhodes Scholar was. And of course, we know who Rhodes is, the globalist and all that. But beyond that, to be a Rhodes Scholar, you never take a test? You never have a class? It is bizarre. And you get a title to go run around and pretend to be an intellectual and read whatever books you deem to or don't read them. There's no testing, nothing. I mean, it's got to be the, you know.
It's a lot of
just,
indoctrination, though. You're hanging out with the people who are this.
Well, you're hanging around. Well, sure, I don't even call today a college education. I call it a college indoctrination, you know. And I think the more indoctrinated a person is, probably the worse off they are for it. That's
yeah. I think there's the only exceptions would actually be the sciences.
Jessica's and Haley are both involved in the sciences, and those would be exceptions. In fact, Jessica was bragging to me the other day that in her doctorate program, they actually taught critical thinking. You know, and
yeah.
You know, of course, that's important. You know, especially for a
yeah.
chemist, you know, or somebody involved in biology, you have to be a critical thinker. That's something that I've heard you promote many times.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, what we do here is critical thinking.
Yeah,
you
want a real critical thinking doctor when they start cutting on you.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, but I'm going to tell you, most doctors.
Are not
have
critical
never taken
thinkers.
A logic class. They've never taken an ethics class. You know, ethics is taught in law school, although most lawyers are not ethical, and ethics is taught in engineering.
Well, you know,
sure
Roy
is taught anyplace else.
Last week, Roy brought that up. He said, "A surgeon, mm-hmm. that's just about memorization." You know, I mean,
that's
what he
correct.
Said. And you know, listening to him as and he was a GP. He's a very amazing man. You know,
yeah.
on so many. Levels, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I poke fun of them, and of course, you know, so does Kirk. When we're at our
yeah.
Mensa meetings, we kind of laugh at Roy a little, but not as much as we laugh at you, Craig. But
I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, that's okay.
I'm entitled to that.
Yeah, I know.
I represent that statement.
That's right. You put it out there, and we beat you up for it, too.
Good.
You know?
All right, let's head to Yashaya. We were a week ago. It's Yashaya 1:27. It says science.
That's chapter what, 7 or?
Oh, we're still in chapter
mm-hmm.
7.
7.
Yeah, chapter 7, right around page 13. Scion, the sign marking the way, by the means to exercise good judgment regarding the way to justly resolve disputes, shall ransom and redeem those who change their attitude and return the right way, causing them to become innocent and upright. This has so many of my favorite concepts woven together. And this, by the way, is an end-of-time statement. We are right at the cusp of Yahweh returning at this point. And so it's Zion that is the only sign that has been left along the way. And so Zion is not a place, if you will. There is no Mount Zion. Zion is actually on Mount Moriah. So the mountain is Moriah. It has, there are three important steps on Moriah. There is the city of Dothan, where Dothan home was. There is the Temple Mount, and there's the summit of Moriah, where Abraham and Yitzhak met to affirm the covenant, and where Yosef fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, and Makkodah. And that is where Yahweh's home is going to be built for the millennial Shabbat. So those that are having a Kiddushin fit over the Dome of the Hoofy Print and being able to build the millennial temple there on the Temple Mount, just cool it. God is not going to place his temple on a place that has been slimed with Satan's Islam. There's a reason when Yahweh says that when he returns, that there will be an earthquake fault that will run east to west, splitting the Mount of Olives. Because if you look at the location of the Mount of Olives, and if you have a fault running east to west there, and then this massive spring of water that's going to well up there, the first
that
thing
means it's going to eat up the mosque there.
The temple, yeah, that's right. Yeah. And so there'll be a bridge over what was the Temple Mount. And what was the Temple Mount and all of the religious rubbish on top of it is going to be swallowed up and cleansed by that river of water that's going to run through through it. When he speaks of Zion, he's speaking of the signposts along the way, and those signposts run from the city of Dothan to the summit of the mountain, and the summit of the mountain is the most important aspect of it. Now, so he has Zion, and the next word after Zion is Mizpah. And if you look, think about Mizpah, which, again, we, as a group collectively, translate Mizpah different than any religious publication.
You know, how do they translate it, by the way? How do they translate?
The most common is judgment. So this would be as in judging people. And so Zion, they never bother. They really never translate Zion. So they'll write Zion with a Z, and they won't translate it. So Zion, which is the signs to mark the way, they just render as Z-I-O-N. And then, so they would make this possessive. So they would say Zion's judgment. Now,
yeah, but they turned Zion into a political movement instead of what Zion is.
Well, their view is that even though Yahweh doesn't refer to Zion as a mountain, and it's on the range of Moriah, that there's become this movement called the Zionists, and this somehow interest in the Mount of Zion, but there is no such place, and it isn't a political or movement. You know, how many people are would say, you know, I'm not anti-Jewish, I'm anti-Zionist. And you're an anti-Semite. You have no clue what Zionist means. But Zion means the signs to mark the way. And when you have, when you realize that signs are placed on the home of the covenant in the sense of the home of Dothan, all the way through the Temple Mount up to the summit of Mount Moriah, which is exactly where the Mizpah were fulfilled. The Mizpah that provide the means to justly resolve disputes were all performed on Zion at the summit of the mountain. That's where
isn't that interesting? So then it says Zion, and the next word is Mizpah. That's
right.
Yeah, that's
Zion
amazing.
Mizpah. And if you particularly recognize that Zion is this connection, and I think there'll be a bridge over the chasm of the water once Yahweh returns, and we have this chasm that sinks the Temple Mount. Because I think that there'll be a bridge that connects Dothan's home, the home of the covenant, with Yahweh's home up on the summit of the mountain, and that when you realize that at the summit of the mountain is where the covenant was confirmed between Yahweh and Abraham. And he made promises in that covenant that were all fulfilled by the first four Bikrei, and all four were fulfilled right there at the summit of Moriah. So,
and that's why you also think that the Mizpah just it doesn't refer to all seven of the Moed. It's just the first four, and I thought about that, and I think, yeah, you're right, because that's where it's all done.
I don't want to discount the last three, obviously Zion is essential for the fulfillment of
Kippurim
because at Kippurim, it's Zion. I mean, it's returning to the Mount of Olives, but there's going to be this giant chasm and living waters that's going to well up, that's going to go right through the ridge of Moriah, and therefore create this bridge spanning those living waters between the city of Dothan and Yahweh's home. And it's on Sukkah that he's going to build his home right there on the top of the summit of Moriah, which is going to, we're going to be told here in a moment. So if you look at the covenant, the benefits of the covenant, the means that Yahweh used to resolve our disputes, Teruah is not a means to resolve disputes. Kippurim is the announcement that the disputes have been resolved. It's not a means to resolve anything. It is a declaration of resolution, of reconciliation. And Sukkah is that now that we've made the announcement of reconciliation, we can all camp out together. So the means to resolve the disputes occur throughout the first 3 to 4 mikrei. And when I say 3 to 4, first we have to become immortal, and that's Pesach. We have to become perfected, which is matzah. So that's the principal means to fulfill the mitzvah. But just while being immortal and being perfected are marvelous things, we are not in the right place. We are not in Yahweh's home. We are not equipped to spend eternity with him until we are adopted, Bukurim, into his family, and then Shavuah enriched and empowered. So I see all 4 of those mikrei collectively providing the mitzvah, and all of them occurred as Zion on Mount Moriah. But this tie-in between the two, I think, is absolutely marvelous. I think that Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavuah represents the elements of Zion that comprise the mitzvah. So,
well, I mean, it says it right there. It says Zion, Bal Mishpat, right?
Yeah.
That's a good catch.
When you
really
take an extraordinarily different position than everybody else takes in trying to convey Yahweh's testimony, and then you see something like this that certainly supports, strongly supports that unique position, it's reassuring, it's gratifying, it's invigorating. So, this is something.
Well, people that are sitting around, just let me say this, if they're going to say judgment, people that are sitting around waiting to be judged are as good as dead.
Right, because if you're going to be judged, then why don't you tell me how in the world that the third word is pada, which means to ransom and redeem.
Right.
Now, if you're
which
being
is
judged,
what was going on in Fremont.
You're not being ransomed. You aren't being redeemed if you're being judged. You're being condemned.
Right.
The best that a judge can do is to say, I've heard the evidence and I'm going to declare you not guilty. Well, that doesn't get you ransomed or redeemed. Right, and the fact is that there is no judge that can declare Larry, Kirk, James, or Craig perfect. There is no judge that can honestly say that we're innocent, that we're not guilty. Even Yahweh can't say that. Now, he can acknowledge that we are guilty and then ransom and redeem us from our guilt. That's why he has Patah here. And the means that he has used to ransom us and redeem us from our guilt is the mitzvah. The first 4, Moed Mikre. And the Moed Mikre all take place on Zion. They are the signs that Yahweh is using to redeem those who are willing to read them, who are willing to follow them. So he put his invitations to these first 4 mikrei on these signs.
I have a note that I did that I just want to read. And, I mean, this is out of yada yada, really, but it described, and what I saw this as the real I see this as the real definition of humble, which is what I call the note. And here's what it says. Permit me, and this is in the Mashal 38, or a proverb. Permit me neither poverty nor wealth. Break bread for me as clearly communicated and prescribed, lest I be self-sufficient,
right,
deemed insufficient by you. This is the religious path he's talking about.
I would tell you, it's just personally. I was once a billionaire. I'm not anymore, not by a million miles. I will tell you that you very seldom find a person who's willing to be reliant, who is fabulously wealthy. And I think, and if you look through history, Iowa never reached out to and partnered with a wealthy individual. Now, there are some individuals who he partnered with who became fabulously wealthy. I mean, Dave Doe at one time was may well have been the wealthiest person in the world.
Yeah, clearly so.
And Solomon was extraordinarily wealthy. In fact, Iowa said, because you did not ask for wealth, I'm going to see to it that you have plenty of wealth. And Abraham wasn't poor. I mean, Abraham accumulated tremendous wealth. So Yahweh has no issue against wealth. But what he does not like is self-reliance. Now, he wants us to be accountable, to be stand-up people, but he doesn't want us to think that, well, we can save ourselves. That we
that's the point of that whole Mishal, is that break bread for me in the prescribed manner. I mean,
right.
You know,
and that's why
if
this is more important to understand. That's why I want everybody to understand this connection between mitzvot and patah, these two words that come next to each other. We are not innocent. We can't be perfect. We can't be declared not guilty unless it is Yahweh having ransomed and redeemed us through the mitzvot. But the mitzvot is his means of ransoming and redeeming us. And it's really important to understand that. And the only way that you get that benefit is to rely on him to provide it. And if you are powerful in the military, powerful politically, powerful religiously, powerful monetarily, the propensity is, proclivity is to be self-reliant. So these things are all related. Now, this next line, the next word is shub. And shub is the means to avail ourselves of those first three things. Shub means to reverse course, to adjust your approach, to change your attitude, to return. Unless we are willing to go the opposite direction of society, the opposite, our attitude be the antithesis of those who have a political sign in their front lawn, the antithesis of those who salute the flag, the antithesis of those who think that the military is providing their freedom and therefore should be honored, the antithesis of those who go to a church or a synagogue or a mosque, unless the antithesis of those who have been conditioned by political correctness to fit in to a multicultural society, unless we go the opposite direction of society, we cannot be ransomed and redeemed by way of the mitzvot, because we will be reliant on one of those human institutions as opposed to Yahweh. No human institution can ransom us or redeem us. No human institution has the ability to resolve the disputes between us and our Maker. And so we have to be willing to go in an opposite direction. I heard a town meeting that took place. The Abominator went out and had a town meeting this week. And at the town meeting, his principal goal was to denounce the Republican-led override of his veto of the 9/11 bill, whereby individual citizens now can sue Saudi Arabia for the calamity of 9/11. Recognizing that 80% of the jihadists that participated in 9/11 were Saudis. So, in the midst of that debate, somebody said, "Why don't you ever use the term Islamic terrorism?" And so
I watched that.
The Obaminator said, "Because it's inappropriate. I wouldn't say that just because a Christian claims that he is killing in the name of Christ, that they should be called a Christian terrorist." And so I don't want to demean the billions of Muslims who are not, who are good people, he said. And I don't want to give credence to ISIL and the likes of Al-Qaeda who have clearly twisted and corrupted their religion. And yet the person who asked the question was not well enough to inform to say, excuse me, Mr. President, there are a handful of people, a minuscule number of people, amongst the 7 billion people walking this planet today, who claim that they have the authority of Christ to kill. A handful, minuscule number, over the last hundreds of years have claimed that they are killing in the name of Christ. Hundreds of thousands claim to be killing in the name of Allah. You know, it is, Mr. President, inappropriate to speak as you just did, because this Christ that you address, let's just use that title for a moment, never killed anyone, never robbed anyone, never terrorized anyone, was opposed to terror. And the Muhammad that you speak of was a ruthless terrorist, leading 75 terrorist raids in the last 10 years of his life. Your example, Mr. President, is ludicrous. We don't seem to have anybody that can pose a question and then follow it up when the politician provides an ignorant response. And this man had his own agenda. This man wanted to convey multiculturalism. He wanted to convey his view of the world. He was unwilling to change his attitude. You will never find God. He was unwilling to change his approach. Even if he had been confronted with the facts, he would have never considered altering his attitude to conform to the evidence. And until we're willing to do that, we can't avail ourselves of Yanawa's misfot and their benefits, which is fatah, to ransom and redeem us.
Well, I don't think anything that Obama has ever said has been honest. I mean,
never.
Anything.
Never.
And the
audience was just as stupid.
Here's one for you.
No one could hold him accountable.
He just gave a speech at Shimon Peres's funeral, as an example, today. And in the speech, he said, here in Israel's Jerusalem. And when in the transcript, they took that out because they realized that we don't recognize Jerusalem as being part of Israel. It's really part of Palestine. That was their motivation. They said that. And I think I live in a country where the leader can't even recognize that Jerusalem, and I know Haifa is the capital, but Jerusalem's the capital. They can't even recognize Jerusalem as being part of Yisrael. And so, you know, I realize how totally hopeless this country is. I mean, you know, if anybody in this country honestly thinks there's some, you know, political savior,
but it's essential to recognize why Shub is so essential here and why 99.999% of people can't Shub. If you find any popular movement, politically, patriotically, religiously, it's not Shub. Shub is going the opposite direction. It's turning around. It's going the way that everybody else
original
is going
path,
against
right.
the flow of people. It's going, yeah.
No, and in this case, we'd want to point out any popular religious movement, too. Any
Correct.
Movement of any kind.
Correct. Right. That's what Shub is. Now, the next, so far we've had Zion, Misfat, Fatah, Shub. Guess what the fifth word is?
Sadek.
The fifth word is the result. Shadak. This is, happens to be Shadaka, which
Shadaka.
Is the feminine version. Yeah, which is just the feminine.
Of
right,
syncated, yeah. Sure.
Right. Yeah, in fact, if you were to
which is pointing at the Ruach, by the way, in this case, pretty sure.
Of course.
Go ahead.
Now,
yeah.
And you know, the key element of Shadak, if you were to cut Shadak right down to its core, it conveys two concepts. both of which are related, both of which are essential to benefiting. The only way that you're ever going to go the opposite direction of society, to be unpatriotic, to be unpolitical, to be unreligious, to not be politically correct, to oppose multiculturalism, the only way you're going to make that decision is to be right as it relates to who Yahweh is and what he is telling us. The only way you're ever going to benefit from the means that Yahweh has provided to resolve disputes is to be right as it relates to what God has said. So one of the two aspects of Tzedakah that is so essential here is you're turning away from the institutional lives of man and to that which is right. And so one of the two concepts of Tzedakah that's important is being right. Right is what leads to all of these benefits. The mental exercise, being right, is getting the correct answer. It's providing the correct response. Now, if I ask you, what is God's name? And you say, Lord, God, Jesus, wrong answer.
Correct.
You've got to be right. There's some questions that your response has to be right. Or you're with all of those other people going the wrong direction. Now, what's the second aspect of Tzedakah? You've studied it, Kirk. You've studied it, James. You probably know it as well. Larry, what is the second aspect
upright.
Of Tzedakah? Upright.
Upright. Vindicated. Yeah.
See, I got it. I know these things.
Yeah.
I know these
upright.
Things.
And yep. What is unique about upright is, yeah, if you were if you lived,
you're standing on balance.
And if you lived in any country now with a monarchy, and you approach the monarchy, what do you have to do?
Got to bow down.
If you live under the auspices of the Roman Catholic Church, and the Pope approaches you, what do you have to do?
You got to kiss his ring as you're bowing.
Bow down and kiss the ring.
Let's say you're in England and you're a subject of the Queen, and you approach
the Queen. Kneel before the Queen.
All right. So. That is the nature of religion. You know, if you're a Muslim, you've got to bow down to Allah five times a day.
Well, you know, if you're a Christian, you do too. And, not
right.
Five times a day. Apparently, it's all the time, 100% of the time.
Right. They have all manner of kneeling apparati in Roman Catholic churches and Episcopal churches and many other churches. You know, it's all about bowing down when God says no. What I'm trying to convey is being upright. And, you know, that's the nature of things. Like, I have a little granddaughter. And when she was able to stand up and walk, it just changed everything in terms of our relationship. I mean, it's so much better now that she's on her feet. And, you know, I can lean over and grab her little hand and help her walk. But she being upright is this huge transition in a relationship. And Yahweh doesn't want us to bow down to him. He wants us to stand with him, to be upright with him, to go for a walk with him, to be eye to eye.
What kind of Adonis is that?
Yeah. That's right, but that is absolutely Edon, isn't it?
Yeah.
Tzedakah is Edon. Tzedakah is the antithesis of Edon. So you have here the juxtaposition of five extraordinarily important words: Zion, Mishpat, Petah, Shub, Tzedakah. Now, this next statement is talking about those who have not turned in the opposite direction, those who are wrong and not right, those who have not availed themselves of the mishpat and therefore who are not redeemed. So the downfall and destruction is shiver. The fracturing, crushing, breaking, crippling, tearing down, shattering, and afflicting of the revolting rebels who have defiantly transgressed the agreement, Peshaw, the defiant criminals who are angry and indignant in their revolt, along with the errant, blameworthy, and sinful, the chata, those who are grievously wrong, which is the antithesis of tzedak. So the first group, the pasha, are the defiant. Those are the ones who are unwilling to be redeemed. Those are they're unwilling to take advantage of Yahweh's. They defy Yahweh's mitzvot. And the second group describes the Zuhut, they're just wrong. The antithesis of tzedak, the chata, will occur all together at the same time with those who have abandoned and rejected Yahweh. For they will perish, be destroyed and vanish from sight, utterly being incarcerated. Kalah. This is Yahweh's return on Yom Kippur. If you're not right, if you have not read and benefited from Zion and the Mishpat, if you're not going the opposite direction of the great masses, then Yahweh is saying that you are Pasha, a revolting rebel, that you are errant and blameworthy and sinful, and that you, at the same time as those who've rejected and abandoned Yahweh, y'all are going to perish. You're going to be incinerated. You're going to vanish from sight. How many religious people were there in Eden?
None.
How many political people were there in Eden?
None.
Once again,
how many military officers were there in Eden? How many patriots were there in Eden?
Good point.
None. Yahweh is going to return the earth to the condition of Eden. And therefore, there will be no political, religious, patriotic, militaristic people left on the planet 15 seconds after he returns.
Sounds good.
All going to be incinerated. Sounds good to me. And he's going to view the religious as rebellious. He's going to look at those who haven't availed of Zion and the Mishpat as errant and blameworthy. And altogether, along with those who have rejected and abandoned Yahweh, they will perish. They will be destroyed, and they will vanish. They will be gone.
You know, I had this conversation this week with someone about this, and they were still concerned about, is that fair? I don't think it's quite that way, but you can see they weren't quite on board with it, and I reminded them, because they've read enough already and part of the family, and I said to them, I said, well, you know, let's think about this for a minute. If we really are going to be in the seventh dimension, and we are going to be light, and we're going to be multi to the tenth power, so powerful, if you took somebody that was a Zob, if you took somebody who was that way, and you gave them that kind of power, what do you got in heaven? And then all of a sudden, you can't get rid of them either. I mean, I suppose you could throw them down in another black hole like you did the Moloch, but gosh, you know, you can't kill these things once you put them, make them light. So you have to put them in some hole.
You have to. And it says they're all going to perish.
Yeah.
Now, the three words that were used here, you know, just like there were five extraordinarily powerful, upright, beneficial, redeeming, correct words that were used in the previous statement. Well, there are three here that you don't ever want to apply to you. Pasha,
no.
Chata, and Azam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting. This is now 128. Yahweh is returned. This is the moment Yahweh returns. This is Yom Kippurim in year 6000. Yah. This is the Day of Reconciliations in 2033. But you know how he started in the second verse, as you know, he's now Yashayah in the first verse just introduces who he is as speaking for Yahweh. In the second verse, he says, "Listen, spiritual realm, and the abode of God, and choose of your own accord to pay attention and respond, material realm, in the land, because Yahweh has spoken. I reared my children, lifting them up, helping them grow, and enabling them to be great, and I raised them, taking them to a higher place. But they have actually, Pashah, rebelled against me. Woe to those in serious trouble, the errant and blameworthy, the sinful, the chata.
Wow.
The nation of heathens and pagans who are estranged, severely stubborn, and heavily laden, dulled and unresponsive with their guilt. They are the offspring of harmful and evil children who corrupt and destroy. They have rejected and abandoned Azab, Yahweh. They have come to despise and revile the set-apart one of Yisrael. They have become strangers, alienating themselves, and have gone backwards in the wrong direction. Yahweh defined the religious and political community that he was assailing between 1-2 and 1-27.
Now, did you catch that right away?
Pardon?
Did you catch that right away? Because that's really a heck of a connection.
Here he is at 1:28, and he is returning to the opening statement, the same three words.
And, yeah, I know. I mean, just remarkable. What a connection.
Yeah. And if you don't realize that these are bookends on what he did in 745 BCE, now 2,777 years later, when he returns on Yom Kippurim, he's saying that the conditions that I just detailed in Yisrael, where he went through and methodically condemned their political and religious approach, he's saying those exact same conditions exist in your 6,000 years. That's why in the intermeeting time, he says, you know, I looked for somebody I could work with. I couldn't find anybody. So we have returned to where we started. I think making those connections is how we learn. It's how we understand. And in this particular case, it couldn't be much clearer.
No, quite remarkable.
That's quite remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's remarkable that we can show these things to people, too, and they just continue down that same damn path, and I just don't get that part of it. I don't.
No, I just...
don't care.
Yeah,
honest,
I don't...
Honest to God, don't care.
You know, God has said... You know, and by the way, you know how many times that Yahweh has used Sion up to this point in those intermediate verses? 3. And so, he's telling us that he left the Zion, the signpost along the way. He's told us that those signposts declare the nature of the Mishpat. He's told us that if we read those and we turn the opposite direction from human institutions, that he will restore and redeem us. And that as a result, we will become upright by being right. And in the midst of all that, he says the vast preponderance of people are going to be annihilated because they have been in rebellion. They're opposed to me. They have separated themselves from me. And he says, you know, they aren't going to exist. We have returned now. This is not just returning to the opening statement of Yashaya. We're returning to the opening statement of Bar-Rashith. We're back in Eden without anybody that's in rebellion against God. Now, while Yashaya reintroduces himself at this point, in Yashaya 2:1, which is why somebody decided that they would call this a new chapter, he's not changed one iota in terms of the timing. It's just, this is like Yashaya saying, all right, we're at the exact same moment of time, but I want to reemphasize the fact that this is not, I'm not acting as a prophet here. I'm simply conveying what God had to say. What he has to say is mind-numbing. This is the word that relationally and beneficially, Asher, Yashaya, son of Amos, the trustworthy and steadfast, the confirming, upholding, and supportive, observed in the prophetic vision, the Chazah, concerning Yahudah and What is the capital of Yehuda?
That would be Jerusalem, baby.
It would be, wouldn't it? And is that must you know, if it's the capital of Palestine, that must mean it's akin to Gaza. Wasn't Gaza one of the cities of the Philistines?
It was the major.
Sure was.
Did the Philistines ever have a community, a fortress, a city, a stake in Jerusalem?
Not that I'm aware of.
No.
They didn't leave much of anything behind.
No. So, first of all, there is no such thing as a Philistine. They're all dead.
That was another Roman trick there, to embarrass the Yehudim at that time. What they wanted to do was just name their country after a vanquished enemy.
Astonishing here, though, and this is the thing that just shows how stupid, particularly intellectuals, are. Because, you know, if Kirk, you've been spending a lot of time in the lexicons. Every time in the lexicons you read about this place, they will never refer to it as Israel. They always call it Palestine, don't they?
Exactly.
Now, the name Palestine, let's just say that I would ask you this question. Where did they get the name Palestine?
From Philistinia.
Right. And where did they get Philistinia?
From Philistia.
Yeah, when the Romans insulted them, when they burned it all up, tore it all up.
And where did the Romans get the name?
Well, they got it from the Torah.
There's only one place in the universe where the Philistae are named. They didn't have a language. They didn't leave any words.
It's in the Torah. That's right. I never thought of that.
There's absolutely no record of them outside of it.
Right. There is no record of a people known as the Philistines.
No. So if that's the only record, maybe you ought to go by the record and see what it said of them.
If you're going to call yourself by that name, if you're going to claim that that people and that place exists, when the only reference to them is in the Torah, then if the Torah is correct, then they are terrorists who are foreign invaders.
Right.
Who are totally and completely estranged from God and wholly and completely opposed to Him, and they were vanquished. And if you don't, if you take that name from the Torah and you say, well, the Torah is not true, then what credibility is there in that name?
No.
How can you be a people
that
only exists through the Torah if the Torah is not true?
Yeah. Well, I don't think
the Torah is true, and all you other guys are lying.
Yeah, but you don't think, and I don't think, and in fact we know, the Romans really didn't care too much about what was true about anything. They were about conquering everything they could get their hands on.
But the Romans only
they can only get it one place. I never thought of that. You're right.
The only place that name exists is in the Torah.
I never thought of that.
The only place
anybody else ever think of that? Am I the only guy?
Philistines had been eradicated by the Assyrians back in around 600 BCE. Rome didn't even become a country until around 250 BCE. The Philistines had ceased to exist. First of all, they were not a significant power. I mean, the Phoenicians that were above them, and then the Phoenicians actually were the people group of the Carthaginians. The Punics are exactly the same people. And the Greeks and the Spartans and the Babylonians became the Persians and the Assyrians and the Egyptians and the Hittites. And I mean, there were a lot of powerful civilizations. The Philistines were not. The Philistines were a menace to Israel, but they were only a menace to Israel. The Assyrians didn't go after the Philistines. The Philistines were simply in the way as the Assyrians and the Egyptians were fighting. And so they were a casualty of a war between actual powers.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is, and they were an illiterate people. And so there's absolutely no record of them whatsoever They are completely unknown apart from the Torah. And so if you take and use a name that is derived exclusively from the Torah, it has no credibility unless the Torah is true. And if the Torah is true, then what Philistine means is foreign invader and terrorist. And if the Torah is true,
they were named country.
They were destroyed. Yeah. So it's an extraordinary thing that that the intellectuals that are so fond of that term, because of course it is derived, it's a Latin transliteration of the Hebrew, are so enamored
when it
absolutely cannot be true. And yet I've never heard anybody just walk through the logic of that, which shows just how stunningly stupid. And you mentioned, you know, the president.
Well, there's the problem.
To,
you're expecting logic from intellectuals.
Yeah, they know many things. They understand nothing.
Yep.
Or you pray them, or you pay them to give you the result, give you something to go with, you know.
Yeah.
And they don't care because they paid for it.
So,
I mean, they bought and paid for it.
Now, as I say, there is the perception and English Bible translations, that because what I'm sharing with you now is Yashaya 2:1, that this is a separate revelation, that this occurred at a different time, that it's talking about a different period, that somehow there's been a transition in the conversation. And I'm telling you, that this statement, all it means is that Yashaya is reaffirming that he's conveying the words of Yahweh, and that these words apply to a people and a place. Now, the reason that the words apply to a people and to a place is God really doesn't give two hoots for what happens in America. He doesn't care what happens in Canada or Mexico.
You mean even if there's a candlelight vigil? Is
no,
that what you're saying?
Does not
even
care.
Matt Hewitt
no
said something
whatsoever.
To me.
God
Hewitt
has
said
no interest,
we were,
and he has never been to and will never go to.
We were fighting a prayer group that was fighting racism in Chicago. I don't even know what the hell that means.
A prayer group that fights racism. How do you do that?
Yeah, I don't even know what it meant, but Matt had written in that he said he doubts that Yahweh even knows where Chicago is unless there happens to accidentally be a covenant member in there somewhere.
Yeah,
but even if there is a covenant member in Chicago, I hope there is. That doesn't mean that Yahweh knows where Chicago is. He would have no interest in Chicago. Chicago would be irrelevant.
Threw that in, and that was a maybe.
As a matter of fact, the covenant member, should they live in Chicago, that covenant member from Yahweh's point of view has separated him or herself from Chicago. So that covenant member, while they may reside in a physical locale, have nothing in common with Chicago.
Yeah, that's right, too. I mean, yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I thought it was pretty... I thought the way he put that was very beautiful, that he got... And I had never really thought of that up to that point. I mean, thinking about
the largest religion in the world today is Roman Catholicism. There are 1.2 billion Roman Catholics today. What is the center of Roman Catholicism?
Rome, of course.
Vatican in Rome, right? Vatican in Rome. And the second largest religion today would be Sunni Islam. There are about a billion Sunni Muslims.
Mecca.
Mecca. So, where is Yahweh saying that his prophetic vision for the last days is focused on the Vatican in Rome?
It's not focused on the Vatican or Mecca.
How can there be a New Testament? How can there be a Quran?
If
it's still focused on Yehuda,
right.
Jerusalem. If you know, so many of the evangelicals in America claim that all of the God's promises to Israel have actually been passed in the United States. The United States is this glowing
revelation. Yeah, I've heard this insane
God
proposition.
And
as a Christian,
time.
I thought it was insane.
Right. Most Christians.
Yeah, and they make this claim. Did God mention New York or Washington, D.C.?
Well, he mentioned Babylon, you know, in the last days, which I think he's talking clearly about the U.S. personally.
Oh, but Babylon, you know, he told about Babylon being
destroyed.
There will be one brick left on top of another. Babylon, therefore, does not represent the country. It represents the religion and politics and corruption that grew out of there. It represents the allegiance to the Lord Baal and satanic influence in our world. But it is essential that people recognize that Yahweh remains focused on Yehudah, and especially on the heart of Yehudah, which is Jerusalem. Where is Zion? Jerusalem. Where is Jerusalem? And Yehudah.
Mm-hmm.
These things are juxtaposed for a reason. The Dabar is being associated here with Yehudah and Jerusalem. But what is the only word that separates here, Dabar, this is the word, and Yashayah, which means salvation is from Yah, there's only one word that separates those two words. You know what that word is?
Asher.
Asher is the visible steps that lead to the relationship. It's the correct way to walk to benefit from the relationship. So this is the word that leads the way to the benefits of the relationship, Yashayah, because salvation is from Yahweh, the son of, the representative of the trustworthy and steadfast, the one who is supportive and nourishing, the one who establishes. That would be Yahweh. And this is what was observed in the prophetic vision concerning, where's the word? Yehudah. Where's the word manifest? Jerusalem. All tied together again for our edification.
So how do you come? I'm sorry, I was just going to say, how do you argue that?
Well, how do you argue the situation where you got Mishpat fulfilled on Zion? Yeah. Zion is not in, the Vatican.
That's why I'm saying this is not a transition. This is just an affirmation that Zion and the means to the Mishpat occur in Jerusalem, Yehudah. That's why these things are juxtaposed to one another. So now I said that this was the end days, the context based upon what was happening, because it's not happened before, and we've been able to deduce this is what God's going to do when He returns to Jerusalem. But just in case you weren't following along in the program, He says it shall come to pass in the last days. Akar is last, end of days. You know, it's ba akarit yomim. At the conclusion of the last period of time, from Akar, afterwards, following something in conjunction with it. Established, firmly fixed, completed and endured. By the way, Yahusha and Yashayah, the same name. Salvation is from Yahweh saves.
Yahweh is saved.
Okay, here in 777 years, exactly, from the time this revelation was given to Yashayah to the time that Yahusha, so it was given to Yashayah in 777 years before Yeshua fulfilled it. Yahusha fulfilled it. Now, do you think that when the disciples asked Yahusha the day before he would begin the first of the four, the 3 days to fulfill the Mishpat, and he was the one that same name, and he's the one that that provided these insights to Yeshaya. Do you think there's any chance that he didn't know the day when it says it shall come to pass in the last days, established, firmly fixed, completed, and enduring?
No. Impossible.
Impossible. And now, what is going to happen? What's going to come about? What's Wahaya in the last days? What is absolutely established, what's firmly and fixed, completed and enduring, that you don't have to worry about? The house, the home,
mm-hmm.
and the family of Yahweh shall exist in proximity upon, if you will, the summit of the first and foremost mountain. Of the mountain, lifted up, supported, and sustained as part of these elevated places. Wow. So, Yahweh is telling you where the home of Yahweh is going to be. Yeshaya is telling you where the home of Yahweh is going to be. Where is it going to be? Is it going to be
on the Temple Mount,
which is considerably below the summit? Or is it going to be on the summit?
On the summit.
And has he already just told you that that Zion is part of this range of the first and foremost mountain?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Is there any mountain that Yahweh has mentioned that he's going to establish as his home other than Moriah? Did he take Dod to Moriah? Did he say, this is where I want you to build my home?
Well,
and now what he's saying is, he says, mm-hmm. I didn't say, you know, when you read the book of Shemuel and Chronicles,
mm-hmm.
it is absolutely clear where where Yahweh's home, and it's never a temple, it's always a home, was to be built by Solomon and Dod, and that was on the threshing floor.
That's not Moriah.
That's the threshing floor is not the summit of Moriah. Not the summit of Moriah. The summit of Moriah is unscathed. You can look at Google Earth. Google Earth, go ahead. The summit of Moriah is still unscathed. You can look at Golgotha and above it.
That's
nothing
right,
there. So here is the place that has the best view. It's the single best location to build in the most contested place on Earth. And there's nothing on it. There's never
That's
been
astounding,
anything.
Isn't it? That's really
it
astounding.
It was just astounding. Yeah, when I found that it was 777 places, spaces from the most set apart part of the temple of that Dod and Solomon constructed to the upright pole for Passover. You know, you just go okay. And that it is exactly 777 strides in elevation above the sea, the summit of Mount Moriah there. But God is
that's amazing. When you say strides, how are they measuring that? Is that like a meter?
When I did the math, what I found was that everything was either 700 yards or 777 yards. You know what a yard is?
So it's like
how
a meter.
You know how a yard was determined?
A step.
Yeah, it's a step. That's right. You know, Kirk, you play golf.
Yes, I play golf.
If you want to know how far it is to the green, you've got a 100-yard shot. How do you?
No, you pace it off.
Right. You pace it off.
And
the average stride. If you look at the average stride of a human being, then from the set apart in the home of Yahweh as constructed in the first home by Dod and Solomon. From there to the place that Pesach was fulfilled, it is exactly 777 strides. And the summit of Moriah, which is where he says, I'm going to establish my home and my family is going to live, it is exactly 770 strides above the sea. Man is supposed to be an upright being, tzedakah. And when we are upright and you look at the pictures of the two people that are in Yahweh's name, their feet are apart. That is a stride. All of this is exactly measurements of 777 strides, just as it was exactly 777 years from the time Yahshayah received this insight from Yahweh to the point that it was fulfilled, and the Mitzvah was fulfilled by Yosha on this very place. When God... Roy's a pretty smart mathematician. He ain't got nothing on Yahweh. Everything Yahweh says ties together. It's all reinforced. But for anybody who has ever wondered, you know, boy, you know, what don't we have to lay the foundations and we need to buy the implements for the millennial temple, and you know that Yosha cannot return until the millennial temple is built. Bull.
Oh, really?
Man's not building it. It ain't going on the Temple Mount.
No, I agree with that. I always wondered where they get that at. I mean, they're, you know.
Yeah, and the other thing
Yahweh's
I really like about
rebuild
this, is the thing that I really like about that, is that I have been to Jerusalem. I hated it there. I really did. I hated it. I will go back when Yahweh returns. But to look on
it's a religious cesspool, I know that.
Right. You look at the Wailing Wall, and you've got all these repulsive, black cast religious Jews with their curly cues and religious outfits bobbing up and down. Well, you have all the Muslims on the top, and and the Dome of the Hoofy Prince, which was a trophy. Ha ha. Allahu Akbar. Allah is greater than Yahweh. We're going to build a shrine to Allah right on top of the Temple Mount, and then that mosque that's up there, and you realize how stunningly polluted, how profane that place has become. And what the Romans did there, where they took everything that was part of that first temple, the second temple, actually. They took all of the wealth, everything that was part of it, and they used it to finance the Colosseum. And they took the Yehudim away to be the slaves to build the Colosseum. And so you said the single most important place on earth was used to create the single most decadent place on earth. And you realize that that is what has transpired here. This is where Hadrian stood and said, we're going to build a shrine to myself. And you say, there is not a chance in the world that the God I know ever is going to build his home there. There isn't enough cleaning in the universe to scrub the stench out of that place. But the summit of Mount Moriah, no one's ever built anything there. There's nothing there. Doesn't need to be scrubbed. That's where he's going to build his home. Of course, the end of this statement, I don't think, belongs with this statement. I think it actually goes with the next statement. But since this is how it's divided, I'll go ahead and share it with you. It says, so then, Gentiles shall flow forth with joyful countenance, beaming with happiness and shining brightly. And they're going to shine brightly over this. Now, why in the world? He just said this is about Yehuda and Jerusalem, and he just says now, Goyim, every Goyim shall flow forth with joyful countenance. Didn't he just say that all of the religious people, the political people, the militant people, those who are in rebellion to him, those who are azoth from him, he's just going to annihilate?
Mm-hmm.
He did, didn't he? Just two statements.
Yeah, that would mean there's going to be plenty of Goyim that aren't. You know,
that are gone.
Yeah.
The overwhelming preponderance. But if you are a Gentile, a different ethnicity, and you survived his return because you read those signposts along the way and took advantage of the Mishmar. If you did that, then you're going to be beaming.
And by the way, wasn't that, Yisrael, Yehudim's job? Wasn't that their job?
That is.
To tell us about signpost and to get us there?
Yeah.
And then they chose.
It means to relate to Yah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
that was their job.
Yeah. Yeah, and they chose, as an overwhelming preponderance, not to do that.
Yeah.
They chose to be a bobblehead at the wall instead, you know.
Right. Jerusalem means the source from which instruction regarding reconciliation flows. That's the purpose of Jerusalem. That's why it was a Zion, a sign posted along the way. All of this ties together. And so the Goyim, those of other ethnicities, the mutts like myself, who are Sioux Indian and Irish, and my son, who is Sioux Indian, Irish, and German. And all of you...
You better not drink. Ladies, you just better not drink. So.
We're all going to be there. Oh, yeah. Between being Irish and Sioux? Yeah, I'm likely.
You'd have problems, pal.
Anytime somebody, you know, a waiter or a waitress in a restaurant said, would you like a second one, sir? Just look and say, yeah, right. You and who else is going to drive me home?
For the love of God, I'm here to make the Guinness family wealthy.
I am a lightweight. It doesn't change the fact that I enjoy a glass of wine. Now, it is important to understand here that God is not talking about nations. Nations aren't going to flow forward. I know that Goyim is sometimes translated nations, but its specific use is to describe ethnicities that are not Jerusalem, that are not Yehuda, not Israel. That's its primary purpose, is to speak of other ethnicities. And
One thing's for sure, I mean, and we went over this last week, remember when he was talking about the salt water, which represented, you know, your Goyim nations,
yeah,
you know.
That, right, exactly.
Yeah,
that's the thing.
Yeah, this is typically not a real good term, but in this case, it is, because these are the individuals who have walked away from their country.
Every ethnicity that survived his return, it wasn't annihilated. We're shining brightly white. We've been transformed into light. And I'm here to tell you that while I know that there are those who are listening, and we're over our time now, so it's not being broadcast, it's still being recorded, but there are those who are ethnically Israel and Yehuda. I'm not. Most certainly not. I'm here to tell you that one of the reasons that I'm going to be joyful in a continent and happy at this moment actually is the fact that I'm not Yehuda.
Yeah.
And you might
because you don't want the responsibility.
I don't. You don't like in our last a week ago, the gentleman kept on saying, you know, you're the guide, you're the teacher, you know, you might want to shirk responsibility, but you're the reason we're all here. And I want to tell you, I hated that. Just hate it.
I know.
You don't want to be responsible. I mean, I'm very happy being one of the family that enjoys studying Yahweh's testimony and sharing what I've learned. And when we can do it collectively, it's a lot more fun.
Well, you're one of the guys that does probably some of the, I mean, even in the family, undoubtedly the best translations I've ever read.
Yeah.
And Kirk, that. By the way,
I'm way down. Don't even bring me in the same.
Well, Mr. Lowly,
let me tell you.
I wanted to say to you the connections you made earlier when you were going.
It's fun in this sense of,
I don't know,
if the expectations are low, and if you have no qualifications, and so by comparison to the expectations, what you do is, you know, you can exceed expectations if expectations are nil. So that's
somebody should tell Trump that, I suppose.
Well, yeah, that's a very comfortable place to be.
Yeah.
The place I don't want to be is to have responsibility. I'm going to tell you that while I have never been comfortable with authority, Yahweh's means of exercising authority is extremely comfortable for me, and I'm really looking forward just to being one of the guys. You know, I've asked for a specific thing. I want to be to bring testimony against Muhammad and Paul and Hadrian. Those are my least favorite three guys. And you know, while I'd like to do that, the fact is, I'm really happy just to be in the back of the room. And when he's talking about his return, I think one of the reasons that us Goyim, who are members of the covenant, are so gosh darn happy is that we have 1,000 years now with no responsibilities to go out and be wholly and completely entertained exploring the universe.
But you know, I thought of something. Can I bring this up? Because this was something that you had brought up before, and of course we, you know, he's talking about making it like, the city of Dode again, right? And
yeah.
Another signpost
right.
along the way.
Uh-huh.
And you said that he's actually going to have people that act as, you know, they did back in the days of Samuel as judges. I never really considered that because I thought, we really won't have jobs. You know, there's going to be low-hanging fruit everywhere, was my thinking. And then I'm thinking, why are people going to be in disputes at that time? But I guess that's the nature of people.
That's not Yahweh style. No, Yahweh likes work. There'll be people working.
Yeah, they just won't be robbed anymore. That's a beautiful thing.
Can
you imagine working without being robbed?
Well, there'll be like
there'll
the Android.
Will.
You know,
there will be people born during the
millennial
time that will be thieves. There'll be people who are dishonest. And
no, there's going to be people that claim to be prophets. We know that because
right.
their
and,
own
yeah,
mother
and
father.
We're going to have the Torah written inside of us. Now, what's interesting is that although Yahweh says that he's going to reside there with his family, we'll be able to camp out with him, and Yisrael and Yehuda and Jerusalem as it is transformed into the condition of the Garden of Eden. But Yahweh is a seven-dimensional creature, an entity. He's not going, all of him is not going to fit there in Jerusalem, which means that those of us who have no responsibility during this period, we can go out and spend 1,000 years exploring the existing universe before it's destroyed, and we
yeah.
will be able to do that.
You're right.
With Yahweh.
Yeah, you're right. So we don't have to stand there and be judges and so
that
forth.
That is correct.
Yeah, this is beautiful.
We are liberated.
Right.
We are completely freed to have fun for 1,000 years, and we will be doing it with Yahweh.
See, now I'm getting it. You know, I was kept trying to. Okay.
That's why when I read this, I said, of course, we're going to be the happiest people in town. You know, everybody who is ethnically part of Israel returns to their region. They return to their role. The Shaphat are reestablished as judges. And Yahweh's there. The Mikra are all going to take place. Everything's going to be organized as Yahweh intended in Israel. And what are we going to be doing? There's no certain allotment of territory for us. We're going to go out and be having a grand old time. We get 1,000 years to explore the existing universe before it's destroyed.
Well, that's a big plus.
That's a bonus.
That's a bonus.
Yeah.
No wonder we're
doing it. I think it's a bonus.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
I guess it's the attitude again. You know, it's a lot of people who want to be God's right-hand man. It's a lot of people that want positions of power and authority. I don't. I don't think anybody who's part of the covenant family does.
No.
Right. So I think that's why we're going to have these people in line.
That's beautiful.
I don't want to be crazy here and to say that, you know, if Yahweh were to say, hey, you know, Larry, I've got a job and I need you to hang here for 1,000 years to do this job for me. You're not going to tell him no. You're going to be say, oh, you know, sure, I'd be happy.
Well, I'm imagining it'd be a job I'd be suited for and be interested in anyway.
Yeah.
So
I might be a little like Moshe and being like, you sure you want me for this?
Yeah.
So, JB, are you telling me trying to worm him out of this job?
No. I'm just saying, I just want to make sure, you know, I'm the right person for the job.
You're the right person.
He's going to come back. And so, Doug's going to be the right person. We don't have to be responsible. And so, I just think that all of us together are going to spend that 1,000 years just having a grand old time. Yeah, so we have, forever to have a grand old time in the new universe thereafter. But I think this is a tremendous bonus. I don't solicit power. I don't want responsibility. I just I think that most of us want the same thing. Let's just go out and have fun.
Can I ask you a question about that? Let's see what you all think about two things came up this week. One of them, I'm just curious. After World War III and then World War IV, and Yom Kippur takes place, and then we're into Sukkah. And he can clean up the world over those 5 days, of course, or he can clean up. Is he going to really clean up the world, or is he going to clean up the Middle East, or Jerusalem and Israel and all?
Oh, what part of the world becomes Eden? There is. We know for certain that Jerusalem and Yehuda.
Right, has to be there.
And because he's returning his family to the original land grants, if you will, that were part of all of Yisrael, we can be certain that Yisrael, Yehuda, and Jerusalem are all turned into Eden-like environments.
Okay.
But
beyond the gate,
personally, I'm convinced. I have no way to prove this to you.
No,
it's just that there are just certain things that are so Yahweh that, and certain things are not Yahweh. I don't think there's a prayer. One chance in a bazillion that the whole earth isn't returned to the conditions in Eden, and that every religious, political, military artifact in the world isn't simultaneously destroyed and obliterated. And every
I think there's a few reasons for that, too. Because, for one thing, for the animals.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for real.
Yeah.
I mean, right. There's a lot of destruction going to go on, especially during World War III, where it goes nuclear.
Mm-hmm.
And the birds didn't have anything to do with that, or anything else. So,
right.
You know.
Yeah, God likes life. He really enjoys life. So I do think that that it's all going to. I think the entire earth returns to the conditions that were prevalent in Eden.
There's a question
and
along
my
those
hope
lines.
Is that the mosquito goes the mosquito and the chicker. And I mean, I've told you the things that God would just say that I don't agree with.
Well, I do real
places where we disagree, and I'm going to tell you the mosquito and the chicker, most certainly the chicker.
Well, on a personal note, I'll be happy that all the golf courses are destroyed, but. No, I mean,
not all of us.
Well, you and Kirk can figure out a new
game. Yard drive that just curves ever so slightly from right to left and lands all softly in the middle of the fairway.
Yeah, well, you'd think you were in heaven down here then, because I got 28 golf courses within a half hour of me, I think, including Sawgrass. But salivating over there now, aren't you? But I got a question for you. And I've read this. I've had people place this verse down in front of me.
I'm going to play every golf course in the Oregon coast. I'm going to play every golf course in Ireland somewhere during that 1,000 years. Kirk and I are going to tee it up, man.
Okay.
If you want a caddy for us, you can.
No, thanks.
I don't even drive the big truck cart.
Yeah,
it's not my idea of recreation.
You can caddy for Kirk, and I'll have JB caddy for me. Here we go.
No, I'll pour you a coffee. I'm a coffee guy.
Okay.
I'll do that.
I've
had people talk about, you throw a verse down where in certain days the Egyptians, this is supposedly after the return, people in Egypt will refuse to come to Sukkah or something, and he will hold back rain. I've had people throw that verse at me a few times.
Most of that from Revelations, so we're not really sure.
Is that what it is? I don't think it was, but maybe it was. I've seen it a couple times. Does anybody know anything about that? It was something that I've always kind of wanted to ask.
They still have free will, so people are,
of course.
And they don't have the Torah in them. They do the people who accept right away, but after that, they don't. I mean, their children won't.
Yeah.
And their children's children won't. So there are opportunities, and there will be a rebellion at the end because he lets Satan out.
Right. Exactly. The reason you look at Hasatan being allowed into the realm of the earth, which is now Eden, at the end of the millennial Sukkah, just as he was allowed into Eden at the end of man's stay there. So if you want to know, is the earth going to be returned to the conditions of Eden?
Yes.
And part of that, part of proof is, guess what? Satan was allowed in at the last moment. Satan will be allowed back in at the last moment.
Once again.
It's going to absolutely, and
yeah, it's the final dividing line. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly.
And I don't think I've just ever really thought about that before, but the reason that we're told the story of the life in Eden ending with the involvement of Satan finally being allowed in, the end of the millennial sukkah, where the whole earth is like Eden, it also concludes with the invitation, with the allowance of Satan into to Eden, which is now the entire earth. That is the end of the 7,000 years. We end up in exactly the same place as where it all began.
You know, you think about the perfection. That's one of the things when I first started reading Yada Yada, where it starts, where it begins, the perfections, the sevens, the seven, seven, mm-hmm. sevens, on and on and on. If anybody thinks, and this is a good one for possibilities and probabilities, statistics, that all these things could come together from the writings of dozens of people to complete this perfect picture, and especially when they didn't live in the same eras, most of them,
right.
You know, they were living in different eras. I understand Yashayahu and Zechariah did, but most of them did not, and yet you take all these, you put them together, and you've got the incredible fact that there are, you know, Yahweh's name appears exactly 7,000 times. That would be one of the amazing...
Or that this was revealed to Yashayah 777 years before it was fulfilled.
Yes, these are all amazing.
Or that the revelation regarding Shaul was 666 years before he wrote his first letter. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Epistle. Right. Thank you. Yeah. We wouldn't want it to just be called a letter. That's for sure.
Yeah.
There are the Greeks involved.
Very important stuff. I found out where that was, and it's not what it says at all. What it really says is it shall exist with the summer fruit as with the autumn harvest. That's what it really says.
Yeah.
It doesn't. It's nothing about Egypt and them not coming to Sukkah and this and that. It's just... I don't even know where they get these translations. It's some English translation. I found it. Yeah, I answered my own question. It doesn't exist.
No. No, there's just, the Yahweh story is consistent. There are no conflicts. And it's masterfully woven together to create this one cohesive whole. And that's the reason why, as we began with Edon versus Adon, you know, one of those strokes fits the picture. One of those strokes does not fit the picture.
Well, that would be a perfect example, if you will, of a light and a dark side to Hebrew words.
Right.
Too, you know,
exactly. Yeah.
And religious copy editors always take the dark side. They always take the low road.
They do.
That's what they do.
They do. And because we live with in a realm of chaos, and you know, as Roy has constantly suggested, that chaos theory is required, because without chaos, the whole experiment that Yahweh engaged upon to create life with free will would have been an absolute waste of time if everything was programmed. So chaos has to exist. There have to be unintended consequences all the way through, and ripple effects, and the opportunity for choices to lead in unpredictable directions.
So, it has to be free will, and it has to be free will.
Yeah, it has to, and that's the only way for free will really to exist. So it all fits together, where God genuinely gave us the opportunity to accept Him or reject Him, to come to know Him, or to align ourselves with man.
Well, I think most of the people involved in the covenant, if not all, are critical thinkers. I mean, they have to be.
That's the only way to have the right answer.
Yeah. I mean, that's right. Just the way it goes. I mean, I don't have to know, as an example, a verse you know, word for word, if somebody spouts it off to me, to know if it's wrong or right. In most cases,
I don't either.
Because I hear the direction that verse is taking, and if it doesn't fit Yahweh's nature, I already know there's something very wrong with it.
Yeah,
and
right,
and this is what happens, you know, over years of looking at his words and pondering what he's saying, and you said a long time ago, you know, you come from a point of knowing to a point of understanding, and that
right,
just inevitably happens. I mean, it just does, and you know, whether it's, you know, because we all learn in phases, and it's like peeling the onion, and of course, there's always more to know in this case. But one thing's for sure, to get there, you have to seriously consider, by tying words together and looking at it as Kirk did today,
yeah,
with Adonai and what all that's really tied to, whether it be Adonis or whether it be something else.
Right.
You know, they're all negative actors,
right,
over here. And just like looking at Bible, that would be a very good example. Or holy, you know, when you came, you know, I understood holy was the most religious, you know, sun festival of the East. It still is, by the way. And then, you know, knowing, of course, Halal Ben Shikar's real name. And then you also have holy meaning destructive, diseased and twisted and all this in Paleo Hebrew. And can you imagine the slight of somebody that decided to call the Ruach twisted and diseased, replaced it with twisted and diseased, and Yahweh's name with Lord? I mean, wow, talk about intentional. These are not accidents.
No. Don't you think the best aspect, I mean, the best thing about Yada Yah and Intro to God and these things is to get your perspective straight. I mean,
yes,
one thing,
yeah,
Craig has done better than
exactly
anybody. He said, okay, let's get our head straight first. These
right
are the key things. This is what Yahweh has said
right
over and over again. This is what's important first.
Yeah.
You know, and then we can peel the onion back forever and have great fun
right
doing it. But then you're just like you, Larry, when somebody says something to you, you go, no, that ain't right. Even
that's
if you
right
couldn't grab a note right away or you couldn't find the verse right away, you
right
know that ain't right.
That's why I
know.
Well,
you know,
sure.
That's why I tell everybody, you know, go read the books first and get your head straight, and then we can talk really seriously.
Well, I
right
think that
yeah
that's what, didn't you say that was the most important part? You know, forget all the
right
hippo stems and the volitions
oh, yeah,
and moods and
right
conjugations.
That's just trying to not be caught in
the participles. Didn't you say
right
perspective was the most
oh
important part? Of,
right.
Yeah,
yeah.
And it
right
no doubt is. It, no, and that part I understand. Okay, I completely
right
understand that. Now, when you start getting off into rules in any language, you've knocked me out. But it has to
right
be done. I understand.
Yeah.
We need
right
people like you too. We do.
Well,
we need
I'm real weak at it, but I have a little chart, and I can say, yeah, okay.
Yeah, I have to, you know, I've gone from being completely oblivious to the stems and to the moods. I mean, completely and utterly oblivious.
No, I remember
to,
you saying
being,
it.
Being completely and totally fascinated by them, because they're, well, there's a lot of times they're used, and it's, the statement isn't tremendously changed based upon the stem or the mood. But there are so many places where the stem and the mood are transforming. They are to understand how God is enabling someone like Abraham or Moshe to represent him, to become the living manifestation of the word. It's just extraordinary. You know, and there's places where he uses a stem with the religious people, and he says they not only perpetrate their lies, they become victim of their lies, and there's a stem that shows that the object not only carries out the action of the verb, but is affected by the action of the verb. And so to have something that tells you that if you're being religious and being deceitful, then you're going to be victimized by your own lies. What a marvelous grammatical tool that is, or when he's speaking to Moshe, or to particularly to Moshe, and he uses the hifl stem, where the object becomes a secondary subject based on the action of the word, and he's talking about, I'm going to speak for you, I'm going to be your mouth, and he conveys it in the hifl stem. What he's effectively saying is, I'm going to make you just like me. So,
no, this, these are all
after a while, you find these steps really are pretty neat.
If you can get into them and you can do this kind of work, it's interesting to hear about it. It's not too interesting for a guy like me to do such things, but that's okay.
Yeah, but I will tell you that it's all part of you. We talk about going from knowing to understanding.
Yeah.
Well, knowing is a never-ending process. Understanding is a never-ending process. And so while we all have enough understanding to appreciate who Yahweh is and to give the right answers when it's important for us to respond, that all of these nuances further enhance our understanding and our appreciation of who He is. So it's just, it is something we will all continue to grow and benefit from. And we don't start off there. I mean, there's no one that says, I'm going to trust Yahweh and I'm going to respond to His invitation because I really like the application of the nifl stem and the cohortative move.
Yeah, you're right about that. Yeah. The cohortatives. Yeah, right.
But
that's right.
When you translate, you know that you're right.
That I did not come to know and trust Yahweh because I learned that Hebrew was the only language without tenses that are stuck in time, and that all Hebrew was, is, and always will be. Now, when I found that out, I was profoundly influenced by it in the sense that my understanding of how this language, how the word of Yahweh and Yahweh are one and the same when both are infinite, when both are always true, I could see how Yahweh was literally being manifest through the words.
Yahweh's name emanates the very notion of Him living in time. That's one of the astounding things about Yahweh's name, in my opinion.
Absolutely. So there's a grammatical artifact that is extraordinarily reinforcing, convicting, edifying, enlightening. It's a form of grammar. But I tell you what, it's powerful. Now, I didn't become a covenant member because of it, but as a covenant member discovering it, my enthusiasm for who Yahweh is and what He had to say increased.
Yeah.
My appreciation of who He is and what He has said increased. So it's all these little details. One of the things that I always liked about every encounter I was ever involved in my life is I always enjoy seeing the big picture through the details. I've always recognized that it's the details that make the picture. And so I always love, at the same time as I'm analyzing the details, to keep one eye focused on the details and the other on the grand panorama that is comprised of those details. And I think that the nature of the Hebrew language is a detail that gives us a much better perspective on the big picture.
You said, Kirk, do you think that was a good metaphor?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I just wanted to
okay, well, thank you. All right, you're going to poke fun at me. I'm going to go home and cry then. No, I'm going to go and take my marbles. Actually, I'm going to bid you all good night.
I've always said, Greg, you're sharp as a marble. Go ahead.
That's right. I appreciate that. Even though I am going to bid you all good night, I actually enjoy, one of the reasons I enjoy this is I like being poked fun at. I really do. I really do. I like being poked fun at. So, don't think, and I think you know that. It's not.
Hey, I'm your man. I've been the yes man before.
I've been the yes man.
That's right.
It.
Isn't that right? Yep, sure is.
Yep.
No. Yes, sir.
I used to pity you. I really did. I'm telling you, I was this guy is on this radio reading 3 hours reading.
But I really liked it. I was reading along with him, and I was just
I am not knocking it.
No,
it's got its monotonous.
And then Friday night we could have a glass of wine and we could listen to Larry and JP.
I actually enjoyed it. This is more fun. Anyway, good night, fellas. It was lots and lots of fun.
Goodbye to the home.
And yeah, and you know, it's there's very few things that are more enjoyable than getting down and studying Yaz's testimony. Particularly,
well, I'm going to be doing my
Teruah
tomorrow night. So you know,
yeah, happy Teruah.
Happy Teruah.
Good night, y'all.
Good night, y'all.
Take care.
Bye bye.
Bye.